It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowans and others have fallen in love with Templeton Rye all over again in the past few years. But the story of this bootleg whiskey that was first produced during Prohibition is much more than a story of illegal booze. It's about a town coming together in a remarkable way and surviving a very difficult time. Bryce Bauer tells this story in his new book, Gentlemen Bootleggers, The True Story of Templeton Rye, Prohibition, and a Small Town in Cahoots. And also he tells that story in the new documentary, West Iowa Whiskey Cookers, which will premiere at the Landlocked Film Festival in Iowa City in August. And Bryce is with me now. Hello, Bryce.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And also here with us today is historian Tim Walsh, former director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome
Hi,
back to the show.
Hi.
And now, Bryce, I know that you grew up in Audubon, Iowa, which is not very far away from Templeton. What kind of stories did you hear when you were growing up about Templeton Rye?
Oh, I heard so many stories. You heard so many stories about people bootlegging it and running it across the state. Most of them involved the subterfuge that they had to do to avoid the Fed, such as hiding it. One of our favorite stories is hiding it in hog lots. They would also hide it in one of the raid stories that we heard was a woman, her house was raided, and she had enough time to hide the barrel in her rocking chair, and she was wearing a long dress, and she put the dress over the rocking chair and rocked the baby, and no one found the booze there. So it was a lot of great little anecdotes like that.
And do you know if they were all true, or did people just make them up to add to the mystique?
You know, I'm sure they grew with the retelling over the decades, but, you know, stories like that, they always have some little kernel of truth to them. And certainly they did have to go to a lot of lengths to avoid the Fed. So
what made you decide you wanted to look deeper into this story?
Well, we always, you know, I'd always heard these stories, and my co-producer in the documentary, Dan Manat, and I started collecting a few of them for an oral history. But we'd always been told there was no documentary evidence of Templeton Rye, and which seemed, you know, logical to us because these were bootleggers. They weren't going to write it down. But when we started working on the documentary more, I ended up at the National Archives in D.C. and stumbled upon all of these wonderful case files that the main prohibition agent in the area, Benjamin Franklin Wilson, who happened to be from Audubon, compiled, and they were just this wealth of documentary evidence that pointed us to other case files and, in fact, quite a lot to newspaper reports of the time that really gave us the basis to figure out how all of the stories we were hearing fit into the larger narrative.
Well, and we're going to dig into some of those really fascinating individual stories. Before we get there, though, I want to kind of set the stage, because I think we all know a little bit about Prohibition, but we don't necessarily really understand what was going on in the nation. And Iowa was one of the states really leading the charge for Prohibition. And Tim, maybe you can fill us in on that. I mean,
right.
Iowa was one of the first dry states.
It was.
Right?
In 1916, Iowa became... It wasn't the first. Kansas was the first, but Iowa became very soon after a dry state. And, of course, it's not until about 1920 that the nation becomes dry as a result of the 18th Amendment, and we begin to implement prohibition under the Volstead Act. What people need to realize, too, is what really was prohibited was the commercial brewing and sale, what bootleggers did, of course, but also just the what distillers did in terms of producing alcohol for beverages that were shipped then, of course, to big cities where you could go into a tavern or a dram shop, as it was sometimes called, and consume a single drink. If you had alcohol, wine particularly, in your basement, or you chose to brew your own for domestic consumption, that was not prohibited under the Volstead Act. And so there were people of means who had sizable quantities of wine, not beer necessarily, but wine and whiskey in their basement, and so were perfectly happy during the Prohibition era because they were not doing anything illegal.
Now, a lot of us think about Iowa, and Bryce, you write a lot about this in your book. I mean, there were a lot of Germans in Iowa who settled Iowa. These these don't seem like the kind of people who would have been leading the charge for prohibition. And that was a source of a great deal of conflict between the Germans in Iowa and other settlers as well. Right, Bryce?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of Germans in Iowa, and there was a lot of Germans in Carroll County, where Templeton is. Templeton itself was something of a 95% German heritage. And the Germans had a very different view of alcohol than a lot of other Americans at the time. They saw alcohol as something that was very social. It's something that you drank with the picnic on the Sunday afternoon after church, and it was something that was very distinct for being consumed with your family. It wasn't so much the traditional American drinking pattern at the time. Was the man would go out and he would go to the saloon by himself or with his friends and get really drunk, but it didn't involve the family. And for the Germans, the family component was there. It was really just a natural, light thing to do.
Well, and you mentioned saloons, and Tim, I mean, Iowa was full of saloons.
Oh, absolutely. It's the poor man's social club. Mm-hmm. I mean, Iowa, certainly in terms of cities like Davenport and Dubuque, Iowa City and Des Moines would have had any number of saloons where people would have gone to meet friends. In many cases, those were places that were being supported by a particular brewery, so that if you liked a particular brand of beer, you would go to that particular saloon. You get a free lunch or a very cheap lunch, which was very salty, by the way, which encouraged you to consume more beer. But it was a way you went to relax after work, maybe have a few beers, and then go home to the wife and kids. And as Bryce mentions, it was very much a part of the social life of the average working man. He would go there to socialize, to share ideas, and so forth. And so to deprive him of that that pleasure was a real sacrifice and a source of real friction and confrontation, particularly among those people in urban areas. And remember, by 1920, half the country was urban, half the country was rural. So you have a kind of a friction point there. And it was becoming increasingly Catholic. German and Lutheran certainly would have been not supporters of prohibition, nor would the Irish have been. So it's a point of real friction in 1920. The do-gooder prohibitionists versus the social supporters of alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Bryce, you point out how many saloons per capita there were in several different communities in Iowa, and it really puts it into an amazing perspective because there's almost a saloon per every 100 mm-hmm. people.
Yeah, yeah, and Des Moines, in fact, had quite a reputation, even though it was illegal a lot of the time in Des Moines to run a saloon. There was a plethora of speakeasies. You know, they would never have been completely crowded. You could always get a drink.
Well, and you also in the documentary, you bring forward a lot of documentation about the Ku Klux Klan, and mm-hmm. We've talked about the Ku Klux Klan in Iowa on this program in the past, and the fact that the conflict was largely anti-Catholic. The Klan was anti-Catholic, and so that came into play with Prohibition as well, right?
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting and kind of unexpected stories that we found when we were doing it. The Ku Klux Klan, this is the 1920s Klan, or the second coming of the Klan. They were a radical organization that was really against immigrants and Catholics, especially in Iowa against Catholics, because there wasn't, you know, very many other social groups that the Klan was traditionally against in Iowa at that time. And one of the things that they saw themselves as doing was being an enforcer of prohibition, and they would be vigilante prohibition enforcers. They would intimidate bootleggers, they would raid stills themselves, and they would try to tip off law enforcement as well.
And you also point out that really without World War I, there's mm-hmm. no clear evidence that prohibition would ever have passed in this country. What was it about World War I that cleared the way for prohibition?
Well, World War I brings us back to that issue of the Germans, where, of course, our enemy in that war was Germany, and it was a country and a nation that was defiled in American popular culture. The federal government issued screeds against it. A lot of people saw them as a big evil component in the country. I was governor at the time, issued what was called the Stanley, or the issued a proclamation against speaking German called the Babel Proclamation. So all of that anti-German sentiment really allowed the Drys to push through prohibition, saying not only is this something that's bad for alcohol is bad for our country, but alcohol is also this thing favored by the Germans, who are enemies. And in Ottoman County, where I'm from, just south of Carroll, the townspeople were so riled up that they even almost lynched two German Americans, basically for being German.
And you also bring Benjamin Franklin Wilson into the story at that point, because he was the sheriff, right? And didn't do anything to protect those men.
No, he didn't. He in fact, one of them was holed up in the town bank where he had been sent to go write out a check to support the war effort. And there was a mob of several hundred men surrounding the bank. And Wilson went in and kind of said, well, there's nothing I can do to protect you. The German who was in the bank asked for a gun. Wilson said, no, I'm not going to give you that. And kind of just led him out. And, you know, either the farmer claimed that Wilson turned him over to the crowd. I mean, Wilson was overpowered at that time, so certainly he could have been grabbed from Wilson's hands as well. But Wilson didn't do very much to try to protect him. And certainly most of the sentiment in the community was against the Germans. They were not going to protect them anyways.
And Templeton was a town that was 95% German at this time, right?
And this were both of these, the farmer and one was a priest. They went and they hid out there when the anti-German sentiment in Iowa was really, or in Ottoman, was really, really strong.
All right. Well, we're going to get to the part where Templeton Rye begins to be produced here after the break. We're talking this hour about the true story behind Templeton Rye. With me is Bryce Bauer. He is the author of Gentlemen Bootleggers, The True Story of Templeton Rye Prohibition and a Small Town in Cahoots. Historian Tim Walsh is also here today, former director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. And you're welcome to join the conversation as well. Do you have bootleggers in your family past? We'd love to hear your stories. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa.
If you can, you better make it to the woods. If you can, if you want to have to leave home, you just mess with a bottle of.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Templeton Rye and the true story behind its brewing. The book that is just out now by Bryce Bauer is Gentlemen Bootleggers, The True Story of Templeton Rye, Prohibition, and a Small Town in Cahoots. He's also one of the producers of the new documentary, West Iowa Whiskey Cookers, which will premiere at the Landlocked Film Festival in Iowa City coming up in August. It goes from August 21st to the 24th. Also with me today is historian Tim Walsh, former director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. And we've gotten to this point where Iowa went dry about 5 years before the rest of the nation, but there were all of these elements leading up to the passing of Prohibition. We have this little town of Templeton that's 95% German, and it's pretty safe to say at this point, Bryce, that the people of Templeton were not in favor of Prohibition.
No, not at all. They weren't before, they weren't after. They started out as being pro-alcohol, certainly.
Now, when did the first rye whiskey come to be in Templeton? Do we know?
Yeah, this is one of the great ironies of the story, is that the first man to make Templeton Rye was a blacksmith with the very improbable name of Herbert Hoover.
Another Herbert Hoover.
Not the one that would be president.
It's not an uncommon name, yes.
Yes, and he named his son, in fact, Herbert Clark Hoover. Yeah. So he was well aware of the connection.
An admirer, apparently, of the president.
Right? Okay. An admirer or something, yes.
Yes.
He was the one that first kind of concocted the recipe, and mostly just did it for himself and for his friends. He never saw it as becoming a big thing.
And did he get away with that?
He did for a couple of years. He moved from Templeton to a nearby Carroll County town called Manning, and continued making it there. But he was finally arrested by the cops. And when he was, he declared to them that he was the first man in Templeton, or in Carroll County, rather, to make Templeton rye. So he was quite proud of his accomplishment.
He wanted to make sure that if he was getting arrested,
yep.
at least everybody knew his role.
Yep, he got it on the record.
So did he share his recipe, or did others also just come up with something similar?
No, his recipe spread around, and he would have been making some of the early stills as a blacksmith as well. So I assume that was part of the package deal, that you got the still and you got the recipe. But certainly other people adapted it then to fit their own needs and their own desires.
Now, we've already introduced this character of the lawman, Benjamin Franklin Wilson, and he's over in Audubon County. And he really is galvanized by Prohibition. He's a man who decides that this is his role to enforce Prohibition. But this is a difficult challenge for him. Why is that?
There's a number of reasons that it was difficult for Benjamin Franklin Wilson to enforce Prohibition. The first one was that after the 18th Amendment went into effect, it was supported by a law called the Volstead Act that set out all the regulations of alcohol and also set funding for the Prohibition Bureau. And the Prohibition Bureau was underfunded from the start. There was far too few agents that were sent around the nation to enforce this, and they had far too little money. So it was really left up to the states and localities to enforce Prohibition. And in Carroll County, the sheriff and the local law enforcement officers were just not going to do that.
Well, and he even ran into that in a very stark way. He made a bust. He turned over the evidence to the sheriff in Carroll County. And then what happened?
And nothing. The Carroll County sheriff just kind of sat on it. And eventually, there's a little spat between the Audubon newspapers and the Carroll newspapers saying, hey, what's up? Why aren't the Carroll County authorities going after the bootleggers? And the Carroll County authorities just kind of shrugged and said, you know, well, you bring them to us, basically. If you do the job for us, then maybe we'll consider this.
Although clearly they weren't even going to do anything.
No.
At that point.
No.
So now Wilson stands for re-election as sheriff and he loses.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think that would be the end of his story in Audubon and Carroll County, but it's not. What does he do next?
He goes and he learns fingerprinting at Leavenworth Penitentiary, which fingerprinting at the time was you know, a new science. And then he returns and he gets a job with the Prohibition Bureau. He starts out based in Creston, but is quickly transferred to Fort Dodge, which is the office that had coverage in Carroll County. And he goes right back to Carroll, and he starts investigating the bootlegging there. But significantly, he can now make arrests in Carroll County because he's a federal agent. He doesn't have to rely on all of the local officers to do the work for him.
And he obviously has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder about mm-hmm. Carroll County and a particular interest in making busts there. But there weren't that many law enforcement officers out there available to make these busts, right? I mean, overseeing all of the bootlegging that was going on in the nation, even just in Iowa, was nearly impossible.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for the underfunded Prohibition Bureau especially, but also small rural sheriff's offices and local police forces weren't prepared to deal with all of the crime that came out of Prohibition. I mean, it was absurd to think they could have done it. And they were more focused on, you know, the things that really get people mad, which is, of course, violent crime and property theft. So Prohibition enforcement was a low priority for a lot of these small rural jurisdictions.
Now, how did Templeton Rye start to really grow in and around Templeton? Because this became obviously a very big business.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the early 1920s, there was several bootleggers. There was a few dozen that were operating and selling it throughout the area. This is kind of before it really took on the name of Templeton Rye, though. It was just kind of known as bootleg whiskey from Carroll County. But then a man comes along named Joe Earlbeck, who was born just a few weeks before 1900. He was born in 1899, so he's a young man at this time. And he is the one that really kind of figures out how to integrate these bootleggers. And he does it by contracting out with various farmers, asking them if he could set up a still on their farm. He brings in the people to run the still and the ingredients, and he just pays the farmers a really quite handsome rent for being allowed to do this. And he's the one that makes the connections and starts distributing it to Des Moines and selling it to Denver and around the Midwest.
All right. And he seemed to have a real vision for the business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a man who was on the make, certainly. He was ambitious, he was committed, and he was smart enough to figure out how to bring everybody in the community into making Templeton Rye, which helped protect the operation and also prevented a lot of the kind of intestine violence that you would have had, that you saw in Chicago.
Well, let's listen to a clip from a man who grew up in Templeton. This is Bob Hoffman, and this was recorded by the Templeton Rye team for the Templeton Rye Archive Project. But he gives us a little bit of a taste of how involved many members of the community were in Templeton Rye.
I don't know whether it's an urban myth or whether it's fact that if you wanted to buy the best rye, you had to go to the Carroll County Sheriff. The sheriff would go out and raid a bootlegger. He'd confiscate all of the inventory that the guy had. Of course, he had to have it for evidence. And then we found out later that evidence was always for sale. Then he also took all the copper that the guy had with his still, and he took that back to the jail, and he had the guys in jail flattening the stuff out. And I can take you today to two houses that still have the copper roofs on that he built back then. So, anyway, it was a great, great time.
So now I don't know if you have evidence that the sheriff was also selling whiskey, but...
he was certainly involved in tipping them off. I don't know if he would sell it, but... A lot of the federal agents, just to address that story directly, a lot of the federal agents, when they raided, the stuff would end up in the Carroll County jail. And it did have a reputation of disappearing. So,
now, try to give us an impression. I mean, we know that Joe Erlbeck got involved. He was a very charismatic guy, a good businessman, and he was really spearheaded turning Templeton Rye into something much bigger than it had been. And other people, many other people in the community got involved, not as employees of his, although some of them were kind of employees, but just as sort of conspirators and collaborators. Can you give me an idea of how the community was involved?
Yeah, if you think of any industry, you know, you have that central function, in this case, distilling bootleg whiskey, but you also need all of these other people around to support that role. So in Templeton, you had merchants, a couple of grocers that were responsible for bringing in all of the ingredients, which would arrive by the train depot. And in fact, one of the grocers, they used some sugar in Templeton Rye, and the sugar would arrive. It would be on the train depot, and at midnight, it would disappear, and the grocer would collect his money and never actually take possession of the sugar because the bootleggers would come and pick it up before they did so. But it also required, you know, lawyers to take care of it. It required rum runners, one of the most famous of which was the town undertaker. And it also required...
And now wait, before you move on from the undertaker, how did the undertaker transport the whiskey?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if he became an undertaker first, with the intention of bootlegging, or if he saw this as a good expedient, because he realized that if he hid the booze in coffins in his hearse, that he wasn't going to be harassed by sheriffs throughout Iowa as he drove and delivered this stuff, because who's going to pull over a hearse and make them open up the coffin in the back? No sheriff is ever going to do that.
Right. You wouldn't think so. So we've got the undertaker involved, and who else?
And a lot of, you know, it required lawyers, it required bankers, it required people to just kind of sell this stuff. A lot of shop owners, the druggist would sell it out of his drugstore. There was a couple of pool halls where you could still get a drink in. And the town doctor and eventual mayor, Dr. Otis P. Morgenthaler, really helped protect the bootleggers. And also the church Monsignor, F.H. Hussman, was not only involved in making it in a distilling capacity, but also kind of provided the moral okay for its production.
Well, and he even worked hard to provide alibis for bootleggers. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was extremely involved.
Yeah, he was. He really became involved. And the Catholic Church had a long history. I mean, the Catholic Church had been against prohibition from the beginning because, of course, wine is very important to the sacraments. And so he really just kind of sat at and he was at the pinnacle of the town. If he had said this was wrong, if he had been against Templeton Rye, I don't think there would have been Templeton Rye.
So he was chief facilitator.
Yes.
Well, Tim, can you put this in perspective
sure.
for us? Because, okay, we have this Templeton Rye being made in the town of Templeton. You have people running it all over the place. But how engaged did Templeton get in the larger network of providing alcohol in other parts of the country?
And when we set the context, we realized that as an agricultural county, Carroll County, obviously suffered through some bad agricultural years in the 20s. And so you're looking for a way to supplement your income.
Right. And we think about the roaring 20s as this very, very good time. But for the farmers, it was not a good time.
It's a time of struggle. And so what you have in Templeton Rye and in bootlegging is a really holistic way of supporting the entire county. And as Bryce suggests, with the approval of the local parish priests. And again, I think it's important to remember it is a German community. There were prohibitionists among Catholic priests, but primarily they were Irish. And the concern was how they were treating their families. If it was responsible drinking, and everyone benefited from the sale, whether the grocer, the undertaker, the mayor, the priest, and so forth, then it seemed to be a sin without shame, and it was civil disobedience. And really, we have to remember going back in American history to the Whiskey Rebellion in the 1790s, people believed that they had the right to brew whiskey and to sell it to whoever they chose to do it, and they weren't going to let 1,500 revenue agents and a few do-gooders stop them from doing it. And so what you have in these communities, and you see this friction between counties, a Protestant town, a Catholic town. Well, that Catholic town isn't going to take orders from some Protestant sheriff. And so ultimately what you have are these little communities that are separated enough distance from one another that they can brew and collectively cooperate and then ship their booze to a place like Kansas City or Chicago and make some extra money to keep things going in Carroll County.
And Bryce, Templeton Rye was a hit in the big cities, right?
It was. It was definitely a hit. It was the biggest hit in Des Moines. I think, you know, we like to think about all of the different cities in the Midwest that it went out to. But its biggest market was really, really Des Moines, because that was a very happening city at the time. And there was a lot of drinkers, and it took a lot to sate their thirst.
They used to say, by the way, too, that farmers would drive to Des Moines so they could do their sinning in the state capital and not get caught back in town. So I suspect that many of the people who were tipping one or two in Des Moines were from other counties,
right.
Not just from Polk County.
Exactly.
they're not all floating in to the molars back in Polk County. So, but you're right. It is maybe it's the first evidence of buying local. You know, we.
Maybe. All right. So Joe Earlbeck is making Templeton Rye. He is coordinating the making of Templeton Rye. He also sees real opportunities with farmers who are struggling, right?
Yeah. The most of these farms were ideal places to run a still because the buildings were often set back. At this time, it was before they really built buildings next to roads. They were set back a ways. And so they had space. It was hidden. It was secluded. And they could set up these stills. And the farmers were eager, and they really needed the money. And it was, you know, it was philanthropy and also business at the same time.
Well, and not only did he need the farmers to distill the whiskey, mm-hmm. he also needed people who were willing to take the fall if they got arrested, right?
Yeah, that was one of the important aspects of how he made his operation work, was he would approach all of his employees and make them take this oath that if you get arrested, that if this place gets raided or if you get arrested, you take the fall and I will pay all of your court costs. I'll pay enough of a fine that will keep you out of jail. But just do not implicate me. Do not, you know, let's not take this organization off at the top.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about Templeton Rye. With me, Bryce Bauer. He is the author of the new book, Gentlemen Bootleggers, The True Story of Templeton Rye Prohibition and a Small Town in Cahoots. Also with me is historian Tim Welch, former director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. We'd love to hear from you as well. Do you have stories from Carroll County and of Templeton Rye in your past? Let us know, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
If the ocean was whiskey and I was a duck, I'd dive to the bottom and drink my way up. But the ocean ain't whiskey and I ain't a duck, so I'll play Jack of Diamonds and trust in my luck.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the story behind Templeton Rye. Bryce Bauer is with me. He's the author of the new book, Gentlemen Bootleggers, The True Story of Templeton Rye Prohibition and a Small Town in Cahoots. He's also one of the producers of a new documentary, West Iowa Whiskey Cookers, which will premiere at the Landlocked Film Festival in Iowa City at the end of August. Tim Welch is also here with me. He's a historian and also former director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. And we'd love to hear from you as well. Are there stories told about bootleggers in your family? Is this something that you grew up hearing about? Share your stories at 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Of course, you can also ask questions. If there are legends of Templeton Rye that you've heard, you're welcome to call and find out if they're true or not. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And so, Bryce, as time goes on, we've got Joe Erlbeck, we've got his organization, these farmers working for him, we've got Benjamin Franklin Wilson, the lawman who is bound and determined to get Joe Erlbeck, and fails again and again and again. But boy, he keeps on trying. And I was really surprised. I mean, it seems like all of the penalties for getting caught bootlegging were pretty much a slap on the wrist at that time. Is that an accurate portrayal?
They weren't real, real tough. They were usually about $300. But to a farmer who's not making a whole lot of money at the time, in the 1920s, that is quite a bit of money. But the Templeton Rye bootleggers were usually got away from actually being arrested and thrown in jail. It was usually just a fine. And Erlbeck was covering most of those fines. So for the farmers that were being arrested, it wasn't a terrible thing. And it certainly came with the sympathy of most of your neighbors.
And when there were raids, there were also usually tips, right?
That kept a lot of the bootleggers out of jail. One of the fascinating reasons why, and one of the other key components of this, was the town switchboard was ran by a bootlegging family, and as soon as information came that there was going to be a raid, all of those party lines went up, and the word went out to everybody who was making it.
All right, so the fine you're going to get slapped with if you have a bunch of empty jugs that smell like whiskey is considerably smaller than if they find you're still in operation, right?
Yes, exactly.
Now, I mentioned before that Erlbeck had farmers who were willing to take the fall for him, and there was a huge raid. The Hog House raid was really one of the most famous events in which a farmer did get discovered. What happened? That was in 1931.
Yes, on the farm of a man named Frank Neppel, who had really been struggling through most of the 1920s, and by 1930, everybody was struggling.
And he had nine kids, right?
Yes,
or something
he had a
like
large
that.
Family. And he had, you know, a mortgage to pay. And so the prohibition agents, B.F. Wilson and a partner of his by the name of F.H. Burris, they had gotten a tip that there was a large still there, and in fact, it was one of Earl Beck's largest stills. And so one cold night, they crawled through the ditch, and as they approached the hog house on Frank Knuppel's farm, they could see lights, and they could see men moving around, and they could most importantly smell the whiskey. So that gave them enough evidence to get a search warrant. And the next night they returned, and they drove straight to the hog house, and they threw open the doors. And they didn't find any bootleggers, but they found all of these. They found several very large stills and over 5,000 gallons of whiskey mash fermenting.
Wow.
Yeah, and so that was one of their largest raids. And a couple of hours later, they stuck around for whatever reason, and at about 3 a.m., Joe Earl Beck shows up. And the officers are all hiding in the hog house, and Joe Earl Beck comes, and he opens up the door, and the prohibition director for Northern Iowa steps out and immediately places him under arrest, and they get Earl Beck.
All right, so they have him, and it sure seems like this is the end for Joe. But what happens next?
What happens next shows how well his organization worked. Frank Knuppel said, no, this is my booze. These are my stills. Joe Earl Beck has nothing to do with this.
He's just visiting at 3 a.m.
Exactly, right? Not stopping at the house, going straight to the hog house.
Right.
So that's the first and that's the biggest protection. But there's a grand jury hearing into it trying to indict Earl Beck. And the federal prosecutors call in the banker because Earl Beck was found with a small little bank book that was showing he was making deposits of up to $500 a week. And they ask the banker, they say, you know, weren't you suspicious that this man depositing so much money at such a hard economic time, you had to know he was a bootlegger, right? And the banker retorts, you know, man, I don't know if you know much about the bootlegging business, but we only ask questions when money's going out.
All right, so of the banking business, right?
Yes, yeah, the banking business.
All right, so he gets a big laugh in the courtroom. The agents look like idiots, and he's obviously willing to lie to a grand jury.
Yeah, which is, you know, a fairly significant thing.
Right, and so it's interesting that that's happening in 1931, because, of course, all signs are pointing to the end of Prohibition.
Yes, by 1931, a lot of America is kind of fed up. They've just seen that Prohibition hasn't worked. And not only has it not worked at stopping alcohol, it has empowered all of these violent mobsters. You know, Chicago becomes famous as a city where you can go and see shootouts downtown. So really, America was turning against Prohibition by the 1930s.
All right. We have a lot of people who want to join in on this conversation.
Great.
And John is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I worked at Living History Farms when we tore down the Greteman store and moved it piece by piece. And it's another little Catholic town close to Templeton. And so we wanted to talk to the grocers that lived around there that worked in the neighborhood. And they told us stories of bringing carloads of sugar and selling them in the dead of night because the farmers had to have sugar to make liquor. They couldn't just make it from corn. So they sold it with the lights off out and back. So that was interesting for us.
Yeah, and the Greteman store, the Greteman family owned a grocery store in Templeton as well and supplied most of the Templeton rye bootleggers.
Fascinating. Oh, John, thank you so much for sharing that tidbit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Jim is on the road and wants to bring a larger-than-life character into this conversation. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning. Say, I heard a rumor a while back that Al Capone used to come out on the train with a bunch of his cronies, and they'd have these big suitcases, and they used to load up these suitcases and go back to Chicago with it. And along with that, they used to go down to the Roswell Garce farm at the River House and kind of sample it down in the barn there by the river. I just want to know if you know if there's any truth to that or if that's just one of those urban legends.
Bryce?
Yeah, we looked quite a bit into the Capone connection because certainly it was a very, very prominent story around Templeton. We didn't find a whole lot of evidence that, Al Capone was involved. And the thing to kind of remember on that point is Templeton was, only about 400 people during Prohibition. The number of people that were required to, support Capone's bootlegging operation in Chicago numbered in the tens of thousands. He had a very, very large organization that was consuming booze from wherever he could get it. So Capone wasn't making house calls to pick up this booze. Did some of it make it to Chicago? Certainly. Joe Erlbeck talks about a time when one of the big bootleggers, a Des Moines man named Kenneth Sonderleiter, who he sold to quite frequently, came in and loaded up 3,200 gallons and sent it off to Chicago.
Fascinating. Well, and it's interesting, you really kind of compare and contrast what was going on in Templeton with what was going on in Chicago and, other areas with rum runners. And, you know, the contrasts are striking because this is sort of a warm, fuzzy family business by comparison.
Yes, yes. I mean, Chicago under Capone was not a great place to be. If you had any kind of connection to the underworld there, you were always somewhat worried for your life. And shootouts, the St. Valentine's Day massacre, which Herbert Hoover had to deal with quite quickly after it happened, was a great example of when a number of men were just gunned down in a Chicago garage in a very, very violent fashion.
The way that things operated in Templeton, I mean, there were dangers. There were very clear dangers. And people did die because of the distillation process. I mean, Franklin Galloway died because of carbon monoxide poisoning in his basement, right? And then there was a still explosion that took place in 1932. And in a way, that was the beginning of the end, except not. It still wasn't as dramatic as, of course, Benjamin Franklin Wilson wanted it to be. But tell me about that explosion.
Yeah, that explosion happened to a guy named Steve Smith, who was kind of Joe Erlbeck's right-hand man. And Steve Smith was going to check on an aging plant where they would heat up the, whiskey in barrels to kind of speed age it. And he had left the burners running, and there had been a gas leak. And the gas caught on fire, and this little shed exploded. And Steve Smith was just getting there when this happened. So he was thrown from the, scene and was burned somewhat severely in it. And that gave kind of Erlbeck just another, point in his investigation and helped him tie in the mayor, Dr. Otis Morgenthaler, and build more of a conspiracy case against Joe Erlbeck and the bootleggers there. However, he still didn't get the, massive conviction that he wanted. Instead, he just kind of ended up with a no contest plea.
Well, and, how big was the fine?
It was about $700 for Erlbeck, and I about $200, I think, for Steve Smith.
So that was Wilson's grand victory that he'd been working for a decade.
Yes, not even enough to, you know, pay a salary for a year.
Wow. Well, let's get back to the phone. Steve is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Steve.
Hi there.
Hi. What story did you want to bring up?
When Khrushchev visited the United States for the first time, I heard he wanted to see Garth's farm, and that in the the security checkout of the area, they turned up couple of stills around Coon Rapids. Is that true?
I would not be surprised. The Garth farm is very near there. And this is, you know, a story that I don't have documentation of, but a story that I heard was that there was often barn dances at the Garth farm where you could get all sorts of bootleg whiskey, including Templeton Rye. So I would, when Khrushchev came, I would not be surprised that they found a few stills.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for your call. And I want to bring Jim on the line in Fairfield into the conversation as well. And we know that Templeton Rye has made a comeback. And Bryce, it came back in 2006. And the people who brought Templeton Rye back and founded Templeton Rye Spirits are actually descendants of people who were involved in the bootlegging, right?
the master distiller, Keith Kirchhoff, his family has a very, very long history with Templeton Rye. The Kirchhoffs were one of the biggest families in Templeton Rye, and one of them that seems to have really skated a lot of the... They were the ones that really stayed out of the Fed's grasp.
All right, and so Jim has a question about others in Carroll County today. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, the discussion about Khrushchev brings it a little bit more contemporary, but I'm interested in right now, today, in Carroll County. I have three forms of Templeton Rye in my house right now. several bottles of the commercial, and one bottle that's in an old plastic black velvet, and one that's in a glass Crown mm-hmm. Royal bottle. And friends pick these up in Carroll County, and they say that there are still people making the good stuff in their backyards.
That's what I hear, too.
No names.
No names. You know, and I haven't been back to Templeton for a year or two now, so I haven't had a chance to check up on their local whiskey market.
It's very interesting. Each one is different. They're all three mm-hmm. good. I wouldn't want to pick the best one, but they're all good and a little bit different.
Good. That's great to hear. I'm glad that the tradition is continuing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for your call. And it is interesting, Bryce, you know, when we think about, and Tim, I'd love for you to weigh in on this as well. When we think about the Prohibition era, and of course, a lot of people think about Al Capone and the stories of gangsters and the shootouts, and people romanticize it, but it's a lot of really ugly, violent stuff. When people think about the story of Templeton Rye, there's a much different feeling. And people of Templeton seem to be very proud of this history, Bryce.
Yeah, they certainly now with the legal product, they have become very proud. When we first started this oral history collection in 2005 or so, people were very hesitant. They were still even a little worried that, you know, there would be repercussions legally for talking to us. And they didn't really, they weren't gung-ho about talking. But I think as they realized that how remarkable the Templeton Rye story is and how well it plays for their ancestors, that during a tough economic time they were able to find something that brought a lot of money into the community and something that they were able to do very peacefully. I think they've really come to respect and recognize that history.
Yeah, and Tim,
Yeah, absolutely. What Bryce says is very interesting because it was a grand, noble experiment brought forth on a national scale, but it was really implemented locally. And so Templeton has its own story of prohibition, and in a way they're kind of proud of it. I come from Detroit, where most of the booze came in by smuggling it across the St. Clair River on fast boats, and people went out to the shoreline to watch the shootouts between the cops and the smugglers. So every town has a different aspect to the story.
Well, Tim, thank you very much for being here today.
Great book, Bryce.
Yes, thank you, Tim.
Historian Tim Welch, former director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. And Bryce, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
Bryce Bauer, author of the new book, Gentlemen Bootleggers, The True Story of Templeton Rye, Prohibition, and a Small Town in Cahoots. And there's also a new documentary, West Iowa Whiskey Cookers, which will premiere at the Landlocked Film Festival in Iowa City in August. This is Talk of Iowa, and with me in the studio now is Ben Kiefer. What's coming up on River to River today, Ben?
Hi, Charity. Conversations with newsworthy retirees, two of them, Carla Miller, 22 years as director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program, will be on, as well as Jill June, retired this week as president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Heartland after 30 years.
Oh, wow. And coming up on Monday, we start our summer series.
Yes, we do.
On the
Excited about that.
In Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.
Way up on Clinch Mountain, I wander alone. I'm drunk as the devil, just leave me alone. Rye whiskey, it's whiskey I cry. If you don't give me rye whiskey, I surely will die. I'll eat when I'm hungry, I'll drink when I'm dry.